You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, we have with us two writers. We have Tim Cahill, author of A Wolverine is Eating My Leg, an original from Vintage in their Departure series. And we have Mitch Siskind, a writer living in California who is a humorist whose lost book, Visitations, we will be excavating and resurrecting. I'm going to start with Tim Cahill. Tim, you've been doing what is called travel adventure writing. What is that?
It's a kind of writing in which one looks at the landscape, the exterior landscape, and see how it corresponds or doesn't correspond to the interior landscape. There seems to be a boom in adventure travel writing these days. The Vintage Departure books are completely about adventure travel writing or travel writing. I was recently in London, and somebody asked me if I wasn't jumping on the bandwagon of something that's very popular now.
But you've been doing it for years.
Yeah, that's what I told them. I've been doing this for 16 years. They're jumping on my bandwagon.
Tell me, you have a previous book, and you've been called or accused of being a gonzo journalist. Where does gonzo enter travel writing?
Gonzo was originally a term that Hunter Thompson used to describe the kind of writing that he did. And that term comes from a man named William Cardozo, who was a writer, a California writer, who was once the editor of the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. Cardozo used the word gonzo because in the late 50s there was a goofy hit rock and roll song in which the refrain was gonzo. And this was the gonzo was the since we didn't know how to describe what that meant, we just used the word gonzo. In practice, what gonzo actually meant was that whatever the story was, it wouldn't have happened had the journalist not been there. In other words, you get personally involved in the story. I mean, when Hunter Thompson got thrown off Muskie's campaign train, that's what the story was about. And if Hunter Thompson wasn't there and hadn't been misbehaving, he wouldn't got thrown off the train, and there would have been no story to write. Travel writing, gonzo travel writing, means precisely that. It's first person, and you look to yourself to see what the outside world means.
Does this first person, when I would hear gonzo used, it was vaguely an equivalent of mad dog. does this require a certain kind of personal stamina and upping of the ante? Is there a risk factor of the self involved?
Sure there is. To do a piece that might be labeled as gonzo, you better be sure of your facts, and you better be sure of your sources, and you better have you better research this story a lot better than anybody else has. And in fact, what'll happen is, in the depths of your research, probably you'll find that you cannot write this story without relating some of the personal involvement. The problem is that every single daily journalist in America would love to be able to do this, and since they cannot put themselves in their own work, they're insanely jealous of people who are allowed to do so. So they look with disfavor upon those of us who do.
In A Wolverine is Eating My Leg, a collection of pieces from, what, the last 8 years?
The last 15 or 16 years.
Wow. There are pieces that take you into darkest Africa, but also into the darkness of the psyche. These travels include the infiltration of a religious cult, as well as penetrating Deanne Fossey's animal preserve in Africa. You have done books on serial killers as well as books on deranged environments. Is the landscape of the mind like the landscape of the earth?
There are places in which one senses that something that happened could have only happened there, that dance macabre of suicide and murder that happened in Jonestown, Guyana, 120 miles from any place, in a jungle environment, in that complete isolation of the jungle. One just simply cannot picture that suicide murder of 900 people taking place in, say, Cincinnati.
Thomas Pynchon has an iconography of North, the frigid part of the soul, the self that disappears goes north, but the self that seems to grow and fester and enlarge goes south, whether that's Jeffrey Furman and Under the Volcano. It's as if humidity creates swelling, and the swelling brain is the ego brain. You've dealt with your share of egomaniacs in hot and sweating environments. Who among them?
I would mention a southern, since I'm from Montana, the frigid part of the soul. Southern California, to me, is rather tropical. And in this book, I talk about a particularly pernicious new religious group, a cult, if you will, and I hasten to add that not all cults are bad, but there are certain bad guy cults and certain references that one can use to say that these are bad guy cults. If they isolate themselves from the community at large, if they've got a group of thugs, enforcers, if you will, if they seem to be tied together by hatred and fear of the outside world, these are some of the marks of what I would call a bad guy cult. And I think the Tony and Susan Alamo Christian Foundation, which I joined in, I believe, 1973, recruited me right out on Hollywood Boulevard. I was standing around cleverly being unshaven and looking confused. I was really good at that. They picked me up, and I went up to Newhall, which is just over the hill, or Saugus, which is just over the hill from where Charlie Manson was, and in the isolation of that semi-arid desert community up there, I spent a week learning what it is that happens to people who join these kinds of organizations. And if you're talking about swollen egos, Tony Alamo certainly has one. I've noticed that in leaders of such group who become godlike. Jim Jones, for instance, said, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the only God you will ever know. Well, being God is an awfully hard job, and it often requires that the God in question take lots of drugs. Jim Jones certainly did, this often induces in the leaders what I would call a clinical paranoia, that sense that I am great, therefore they persecute me. They persecute me, therefore I am great. I don't know. I'd like to persecute Tony Alamo a little bit. He's that person that you've seen those bills slapped up around town sometimes that excoriate the Catholic Church.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's Tony Alamo.
Now, one of the hallmarks of the Tim Cahill style of writing is humor, and I remember laughing out loud when reading the essay on the Alamos, True Believers, and the Guises of the Weasel being the devil in his manifold forms, that you have a section in which you're taken in and asked or encouraged to speak in tongues, to become a glossolalist. It's a terrific section. What did you sound like?
Well, first of all, let me say that there are honest and sincere people who speak in tongues as part of their religious ceremonies, and I'm not making fun of them, but I'm certainly making fun of what Tony and Susan Alamo required their followers to do, which was, as I joined the organization, I was taken into a small room that was rather like a closet, and there were about 40 people there, and they suggested that I rock back and forth and say, "Thank you, Jesus, praise you, Jesus," as fast as I possibly could, and that since the Bible said followers of the Lord would be able to speak in diverse tongues, that soon it would come to me and I would be speaking in diverse tongues. And I was rocking back and forth saying, "Thank you, Jesus, praise you, Jesus." And I thought maybe I could get to it organically and not have to fake it. But after about, well, I would say 3 hours, I noticed that I was getting this unpleasant prayer sore at the base of my spine and that I really was not going to get out of this box until I started speaking in tongues. And I tell you, if you've chanted for about 3 hours, your tongue gets a little loose and the inside of your head vibrates a bit as well. So I probably wouldn't do it as well right now as if I'd been chanting for some time, but the way I did it sounded a little bit like... Do that for 3 or 4 hours and you'll be empty and mindless, I guarantee.
I went out to the desert several months ago, and famously non-visual, the naturalist I went with asked me, "Did I notice anything strange about the desert, its plants?" I kind of looked around and just thought it was an alternate environment, and then she had to point out to me that in the desert, those spindly plants cast no shadow. And one of the reasons why in aerial photographs from up above the deserts look plantless is simply because they don't leaf out in the shadow-casting way, but that wildflowers of every imaginable sort bloom there. Now, you spent your time in deserts in the Southwest, and you have an essay in "A Wolverine Is Eating My Leg" on fear of frying.
Yes. In what's happened to us, I think, in America is that attorneys have begun describing what is dangerous, and when attorneys describe what's dangerous, nothing is safe. Therefore, when you go to national parks now, they're erecting guardrails around cliffs, and they're putting up signs explaining the concept of gravity. And to look for any challenge in the, you know, it's as if the remaining wilderness areas of our country, where I live, should be Disneyland, where nobody can get hurt. And that's precisely and specifically what a wilderness area should be for, to get in touch with something creatural in us, and there should be a sense of risk. And what I decided to do was impose a sense of risk on the wilderness by setting up a self-proposed challenge, and that was to walk from the lowest point in the continental United States, which is Death Valley at 282 feet below sea level, to Mount Whitney, which is a little under 15,000 feet, and they're about 100 miles apart. So we walked across, my friend photographer Nick Nichols and myself walked across Death Valley. And that I learned something about Death Valley that very few people know. I mean, this is a great salt pan that you look at, and it's surrounded by very high mountains. Telescope Peak is about 11,000 feet. You look at this and you say, this should be a lake. It wants to be a lake. The sun won't let it be a lake. But when you get out in the lowest point in the continental United States, what you are walking on is a very thin crust of salt, and it's like walking on crusty snow. You crack through, and all of a sudden you're knee-deep or thigh-deep in unpleasant hot mud. And this makes for an extremely difficult walk. So this was perhaps the, within the first, I discovered this thing that I didn't know about Death Valley within the first few hours that I was there. But what happened after that was I'd planned to sleep during the day and walk at night when it was cooler, and I set up a shade, and I left my boots on the ground. Now, what kills you in Death Valley is not so much the 110, 120 degree heat, it's the ground. The Indian word for Death Valley is ground on fire, and the ground itself has been measured as high as 200 degrees. So I left my mud-caked boots on the 200-degree ground, which meant they were baked into weird and unfoot-like shapes, and and I had to walk the rest of the 100 miles in these cruel shoes.
Tim Cahill has collected around 18 years of essays in adventure travel in A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. He takes us to the jungles. He takes us to the deserts. He takes us to the hoaxes of Bigfoot and his own famous hoax, Moby Pike. One of the great joys is that in addition to the gonzo side of Tim Cahill, there's the Gene Shepard side. Gene Shepard is an early or proto-Garrison Keillor, and there's a kind of beautiful folksy hilarity in the way these stories get told. I'm very happy to have had you on the show today, and I recommend The Wolverine is Eating My Leg from Vintage Books to all our listeners.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. My second guest today is Mitch Siskind, who lives in Los Angeles and is the target of a long quest of my own, not quite as dangerous as some of Tim Cahill's, but certainly as ardent. I was in a writing class some 15 years ago with Donald Barthelme, and Donald mentioned a young writer who had never published a book, but who had a faultless comic ear. Barthelme was not a person who recommended things casually. You know, only people like Grace Paley, and I made it my business to find out who this Mitch Siskind was. Little magazines yielded stories. A textbook threw open a story called A Mean Teacher, one of the funniest growing up in school stories in all American fiction. And happily, one discovered Mitch Siskind at a gemology institute in Los Angeles. What brought you there, Mitch?
On the night that Jimmy Carter was elected president, I was walking down the street in Chicago, and I saw something glistening, and I picked it up, and it was a diamond. And I thought, this must be some sort of omen. Give me some direction. And particularly because it was a night when a lot was happening. And I went to work in a jewelry store because I had found this object. And they did tell me it was indeed a diamond. And they said if you wanted to get ahead in the jewelry business, you should go to the Gemological Institute in California. So that's how I, and I did. I didn't get ahead in the jewelry business, but I went to the Gemological Institute.
In the course of tracking Mitch down, I discovered that a small press had put together a collection of his pieces. This collection was called Visitation. What was the name of the press?
Brightwaters Press.
And no sooner had the book come out, virtually, than the press went bankrupt. And so books were spilled out haphazardly around the country, but not very widely. And I managed to get one. Thrilled with, you know, finding Mitch Siskind stories that I hadn't read before, and began a campaign to find him and get him public. He read at Beyond Baroque. He taught at one of the Santa Monica College writing conferences along with Ann Beattie and Mona Simpson. And it was, you know, really a joy. But then the book just disappeared. House went bankrupt, and a great deal of trouble was taken to reconquer the missing wealth of the stories in Visitations. How did you suddenly end up recently with 1,400 copies?
Well, the person who had the books decided that he was going to sell the warehouse where they were being stored. So he offered them to me, since under the contract originally, if the publishing house went out of business, they belonged to me. I had to pay for the amount of time that they'd been stored, which was about 2,000 years, but I was more than willing to do that in order to get a hold of the Visitations.
You told me a story that you'd like to write someday, a biblical story about a saint. Could you tell it?
St. Wiljafortis.
Yes.
This is a story that I bought an Oxford Book of the Saints, Lives of the Saints, to try to get ideas for stories. And there was the story of St. Wiljafortis, which I wanted to put into a contemporary California setting. I've tried a number of times. It's a story of a very attractive young woman who was betrothed to a well-to-do man, but who had the young woman wasn't in love with him. And in order to try to avoid the marriage to the man, which her father was promoting upon her, she prayed that she might become physically unattractive. Specifically, she prayed that she could grow a beard. And she did grow a beard. And more than growing a beard, she started to look like Jesus. And her father was infuriated, of course, that the rich man was no longer attracted to her. And he crucified her. So it was a happy ending, in a sense, for her.
And how? What have been the attempts to update this to a Californian setting?
Well, I tried to write a story about a young woman who was hanging out on Sunset Boulevard who got picked up by a guy in a fancy sports car. And that was about as far as I got.
One of the happy things is we're going to be offering copies of Visitations. These are, you know, unavailable anywhere else. If you would like a copy of Visitations by Mitch Siskind, call us now at 213-520-5279. The first five callers who name the book and who have not received a gift from KCRW in the past 30 days will receive a copy, compliments of KCRW 89.9 FM. What kind of response do you expect to get to this kind of offer?
I hope I get a big response. But I really don't know, Michael. I'm not that well known here in California, not like in other parts of the country. And this will be the start, I hope, of some interest in the book.
I hear that you've been at work on a hamburger saga. Could you
tell us? The story of the $2 million hamburger.
The story of the $2 million hamburger.
Cooked just the way you want it.
Yeah.
There is a restaurant where a hamburger was for sale for $2 million. It was a special item on the menu. And someone came and bought one.
And really?
When I heard about this story, I was fascinated by it, and I've done a lot of work on it, and I've interviewed the principals, and it's a story that, you know, I'm anxious to get told.
And you've been you've been keeping this story under wraps for some time, haven't you?
I have been keeping it under wraps, but now I'm ready to unwrap it and show it to the world.
Tell me, you've seen, you know, Mitch and I started having weekly lunches at the Bellage Hotel, partially because I like to be in the company of someone whose deadpan is as elaborate.
Dead.
Dead as Buster Keaton's. Mitch told me, I think, at our first meeting at a store that he refused to reveal the whereabouts to the David Letterman people. Would you tell me about that store?
The store with a million items?
Yeah, the store with a million items.
There was a store called the Store with a Million Items. When you went inside, there really weren't anywhere near a million items. It was just kind of dusty shelves with some big chief brand writing tablets on them. This was a store that the David Letterman show was interested in doing a piece on. But I felt like I wanted to preserve the secret location of the store. So I wouldn't tell them where it was, and they didn't make me any offers of any kind.
Does the store exist still?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Now I can say where it was. It was on the corner. I think it was Weston and Melrose.
Did you get to know the owners of the store?
No, I didn't. I was only in there once. There was someone selling, actually, jewelry. It was a kind of interesting thing. There was a guy selling turquoise jewelry from a briefcase at the coffee counter. It also had a coffee counter.
What are you at work on now, Mitch?
Good question. I've been doing some advertising writing. I write direct mail advertisements for How to Be Successful books, successfully. And they're books that always say you should be very outgoing. So there's a real irony there because I'm rarely out of my house. I'm a kind of very retiring person. But I write these ads urging people to be very outgoing. And they've been quite successful.
Do you have some fiction in project? Some fiction in progress?
I've been wanting for a long time to write a novel about the people who raise fighting dogs. And I'm beginning to think now that I can somehow integrate these success-oriented books that I've been writing about a person who's puts those notions into practice in trying to raise successful fighting dogs.
That's wonderful. I'm very happy to have Mitch Siskind, who I consider to be one of the great unknown American writers, in Los Angeles, across from me at lunch tables, and now across from me at the radio studio. I think that he's really one of the funniest people in the world and one of the most unusual. Once again, please call for a copy of Visitations if you want to take a look at probably the most peculiar comic writing in America. And thank you very much. This is Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. I want to thank Judy Cash, my associate producer, and Bob Carlson, my editor. We've been with Tim Cahill and Mitch Siskind. Good afternoon.
We'll take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
Tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.